In 1924, E.M. Forster published what would become his final novel, a work that continues to resonate nearly a century later. A Passage to India emerged from Forster's own experiences in the subcontinent and his deep discomfort with British colonial rule. The book was an immediate sensation, winning the James Tait Black Memorial Prize and establishing itself as one of the most insightful examinations of cross-cultural relations ever written. Salman Rushdie has called it the greatest novel about India written by an Englishman, while Zadie Smith considers it a masterpiece of psychological complexity. The novel's exploration of cultural misunderstanding, racial tension, and the human yearning for connection across divides feels startlingly relevant in our own polarized times. When the BBC conducted its Big Read survey of Britain's best-loved novels, A Passage to India ranked 25th, evidence of its enduring impact on readers and its continued ability to challenge our assumptions about identity, empire, and the possibility of friendship across seemingly unbridgeable divides. Chandrapur embodies the stark divisions of British India, a microcosm of empire where geography mirrors social hierarchy. The city sprawls along the unholy Ganges, its native quarters characterized by mean streets and ineffective temples, mud-walled houses, and cramped bazaars teeming with life, yet devoid of architectural distinction. Yet viewed from a distance, the civil station creates an illusion of a city of gardens on higher ground, with its ordered rows of eucalyptus trees, manicured lawns, and whitewashed bungalows screening the squalor below. This physical arrangement, British officials literally looking down upon the Indian population, perfectly captures the colonial mindset and serves as a powerful metaphor for imperial authority. The novel opens with this telling description, immediately establishing the separation between rulers and ruled. The English newcomers initially delight in the verdant illusion of Chandrapur until they discover the reality beneath. The dust, the poverty, the overwhelming heat that reduces their romantic notions to ash. Above it all stretches an enormous dome of blue sky that settles everything, nature indifferent to human divisions, serving as both backdrop and silent judge to the colonial drama unfolding below. In the distance loom the Malabar Hills with their mysterious caves, a primordial presence that will later become the catalyst for the novel's central crisis, their ancient indifference mocking the temporary nature of British rule. Within this divided landscape, characters navigate complex social codes that govern every interaction. The English maintain their exclusive club, a sanctuary of imported customs where no Indians are permitted, complete with tennis courts, bridge tables, and gin and tonics at sunset. They live in bungalows with well-tended gardens, served by Indian staff they rarely truly see, bearers, punkawallas, and sweepers who move like shadows through their lives. Dr. Aziz, cycling to answer a summons from the civil surgeon only to find him absent without apology, experiences the inevitable snub when English ladies commandeer his tonga without acknowledgement. Such daily humiliations, from ignored greetings to dismissed expertise, reveal the casual cruelty of the colonial system and its impact on educated Indians who must constantly navigate this maze of racial prejudice. Even well-meaning attempts at connection fail spectacularly. The Collector's Bridge Party, ostensibly organized to bring together English and Indians, only reinforces divisions through its awkward formality and forced interactions. Mrs. Turton grows visibly uncomfortable when Indian ladies respond to her patronizing attempts at simple conversation in perfect English, mentioning European landmarks and displaying cultural knowledge that threatens her sense of superiority. Miss Quested's earnest attempts to engage with them fail against the echoing walls of their civility, her anthropological curiosity meeting polite resistance. The physical and social architecture of Chandrapur ensures that true understanding remains elusive, with each group trapped in their own perspective, looking at the other across an unbridgeable divide reinforced by centuries of colonial rule and mutual misunderstanding. In the cool evening air of a mosque, the novel's first meaningful cross-cultural connection occurs. After experiencing humiliation at the hands of the English, particularly Major Callender, who had summoned and then abandoned him, Dr. Aziz seeks solace in the mosque's serene architecture. Here, he contemplates Islam as more than a faith, seeing it as a way of life that provides structure and meaning beyond mere religious doctrine. The mosque's geometric patterns and peaceful atmosphere offer him refuge from the colonial world's chaos and indignities. His meditative solitude is interrupted when he angrily confronts an Englishwoman for entering, displaying the defensive posture many Indians had adopted toward the British. However, his hostility dissolves upon discovering she has respectfully removed her shoes, a small but significant gesture of cultural awareness rarely shown by the British. This woman, Mrs. Moore, turns out to be the mother of the city magistrate, Ronnie Heeslop, though her demeanor differs markedly from the typical Anglo-Indian attitude. Their encounter unfolds with remarkable tenderness and authenticity. They discover surprising parallels. Both have three children, both appreciate the mosque's spiritual atmosphere, and both feel somewhat out of place in their current circumstances. Aziz finds unexpected sympathy from her regarding his treatment by the Callenders, and her genuine interest in his life and perspectives stands in stark contrast to the dismissive attitude he usually encounters from the British. The mosque becomes a liminal space where the rigid social barriers of Chandrapur momentarily dissolve, allowing for genuine human connection across the colonial divide. Mrs. Moore's natural empathy and spiritual sensitivity create an atmosphere where Aziz feels a sudden sense of unity, of kinship with the heavens. This moment transcends mere social pleasantries, suggesting the possibility of genuine understanding between colonizer and colonized. The architectural beauty of the mosque, with its arches and courtyards, serves as both backdrop and catalyst for this rare moment of cross-cultural harmony. This connection, however fragile, stands in stark contrast to the attitudes of Mrs. Moore's son, Ronnie, who has been transformed by his position as city magistrate. The colonial administration has molded him into a typical Anglo-Indian official, suspicious of native intentions and dismissive of individual relationships. When Mrs. Moore relates her pleasant encounter with Dr. Aziz, Ronnie's bureaucratic mindset immediately surfaces. He insists on reporting that Aziz dislikes Major Callender, despite his mother's protests about betraying a private conversation. His declaration that nothing's private in India reveals the surveillance mentality of colonial administration, while his suspicion that Aziz had ulterior motives, trying to impress her with manly independence, demonstrates the ingrained prejudices of the British Raj. Mrs. Moore's observation that Ronnie never judged people this way at home elicits his telling response, "India isn't home." This simple statement encapsulates how thoroughly he has absorbed the colonial mindset, viewing India as a place where different rules apply and where normal human relationships must be subordinated to imperial power structures. The warmth of the mosque encounter gives way to the chill of imperial attitudes, highlighting the novel's central tension between human connection and systemic division. Later, alone in her room, Mrs. Moore's reflection on the mosque encounter demonstrates her unique perspective. While acknowledging Aziz's flaws, his tendency toward exaggeration and emotional volatility, she feels that Ronnie's summary missed the essential life of him. This capacity to see beyond categories to the individual person distinguishes Mrs. Moore throughout the novel, making her a moral touchstone even after her physical departure. Her ability to recognize and value human complexity rather than reducing individuals to colonial stereotypes establishes her as a bridge between cultures and a voice of authentic human connection in a divided world. Mr. Fielding, principal of the Government College, emerges as the novel's most determined bridge builder between the British and Indian communities. Unlike most English officials who maintain rigid social barriers, he mingles freely with Indians and treats them as intellectual and social equals. His decision to host a tea party for Miss Quested and Mrs. Moore, while deliberately including Dr. Aziz and Professor Godbole, represents a bold attempt to create a rare social space where genuine cross-cultural conversation might flourish beyond the constraints of colonial hierarchy. The setting itself becomes symbolic of cultural fusion. Fielding's house, with its distinctive blue-painted pillars and pavilions carved to imitate bamboo, represents a hybrid architectural space that is neither purely English nor Indian. The house's design reflects Fielding's own position as a mediator between cultures, incorporating elements of both colonial and local aesthetics. The garden, visible through wide windows, provides a neutral ground where East and West might meet without the usual social strictures. During the gathering, Aziz reveals a more intimate side of his personality, enthusiastically sharing his romantic vision of justice as practiced by the Mughal emperors. He describes in detail how he would dispense mercy and wealth, giving rupees to poor widows and showing compassion to criminals. This moment of vulnerability, rare in his interactions with the English, reveals his deep connection to Islamic traditions of governance and his idealistic nature. His face softens as he speaks, dropping the defensive manner he typically adopts in British company. Professor Godbole's arrival adds complexity to the cultural dynamics. The elderly Brahmin presents an intriguing figure, fair-complexioned with gray-blue eyes, wearing Western socks that exactly match his traditional purple turban. This careful coordination suggests a deliberate attempt to harmonize Eastern and Western elements in his appearance. However, when the conversation turns to the Marabar Caves, Godbole's typical response, "There is an entrance in the rock which you enter, and through the entrance is the cave," reveals the limits of cross-cultural communication. Despite repeated questions, he maintains an enigmatic silence that suggests some experiences remain fundamentally untranslatable between cultures. The Tea Party represents the novel's pinnacle of potential understanding between the communities. The conversation flows naturally, touching on art, philosophy, and personal experiences. Cultural barriers temporarily lower as genuine curiosity emerges on all sides. Aziz, caught up in the warmth of the moment, impulsively invites everyone to visit the Marabar Caves, though he has never visited them himself. A spontaneous gesture of hospitality that will later have profound consequences. The arrival of Ronnie Heeslop, the city magistrate, abruptly disrupts this delicate harmony. His presence reintroduces the rigid colonial hierarchy that the gathering had momentarily transcended. The absolute silence that falls after his departure, no ripple disturbed the water, no leaf stirred, becomes deeply symbolic, marking a crucial turning point after which the possibility of genuine understanding between the communities begins to fade. The Marabar Caves form the novel's dark center, a place of primordial emptiness that strips away human pretensions. These hills are older than anything in the world, untouched by water since land began, representing flesh of the sun's flesh. The caves themselves possess an unsettling uniformity, each consisting of an 8-foot tunnel leading to a circular 20-foot chamber, with no distinguishing features between them. When the expedition finally occurs, Fielding and Professor Godbole miss the train, leaving Aziz to host the English ladies alone. The landscape they traverse produces a spiritual silence which invaded more senses than the ear. Everything seems cut off at its root and infected with illusion. Even simple observations, whether certain mounds or graves or breasts of the goddess Parvati, whether an object is a snake or tree stump, remain ambiguous, with villagers contradicting themselves. This epistemological uncertainty foreshadows the central crisis to come. Inside the first cave, Mrs. Moore nearly faints from the crowded conditions, bad smell, and terrifying echo, boom, that renders all human experience meaningless. The echo haunts her, suggesting that pathos, piety, courage, they exist, but are identical, and so is filth. Everything exists, nothing has value. This nihilistic revelation undermines her Christian faith and her belief in human connection. Meanwhile, Aziz takes Adela to Themore Caves. As they climb, Adela suddenly realizes she doesn't love Ronnie, the man she's going to marry. She questions Aziz about his marriage, unintentionally offending him with her inquiry about whether he has multiple wives. Disturbed, Aziz retreats into a cave to compose himself, while Adela, unaware of her blunder, enters another cave. What happens next, or doesn't happen, becomes the novel's central mystery and the catalyst for unleashing the latent racial tensions of colonial India. The caves represent an existential void where human categories collapse. Their perfect emptiness and the meaningless echo that transforms all sounds into the same boom suggest the ultimate futility of human attempts at distinction and meaning. Against this primordial backdrop, the social constructs of empire appear particularly fragile and arbitrary. The accusation that Aziz assaulted Miss Quest in the Marabar Caves ignites the simmering racial tensions of Chandrapur. The English community immediately closes ranks, treating the accusation as unquestionable truth. The collector, white-faced and almost fanatical, informs Fielding that Miss Quested has been insulted in one of the Marabar Caves. When Fielding protests Aziz's innocence, Turton sees this as another insult. He delivers a speech about his 25 years of experience, proving that intimacy between English and Indians always leads to disaster. The machinery of colonial justice grinds into motion. Mr. McBride, the thoughtful district superintendent of police, detains Aziz with relative courtesy. Though educated and reflective, McBride believes all natives are criminals due to geography, his climatic zones theory. The broken field glasses found in Aziz's pocket become damning evidence, though they prove nothing about what actually occurred in the cave. The trial becomes a flashpoint for broader tensions. The English treat Ronnie Heeslop as a martyr bearing the Sahib's cross, while Indians rally behind Aziz. Major Callender spins an elaborate conspiracy theory about Aziz plotting to suffocate Mrs. Moore before assaulting Miss Quested. When Fielding makes his stand, "I believe Dr. Aziz to be innocent," he's immediately ostracized from English society, ordered to leave the club, and called weak by the collector. Meanwhile, Mrs. Moore, increasingly detached and irritable after her cave experience, delivers a disjointed monologue about duty and the echo that haunts her. She refuses to help torture Aziz for something he didn't do, explaining she knows his character. When Adela briefly suggests withdrawing the case, she immediately acknowledges it's impossible as the machinery has started. This machinery, the colonial legal system, takes on a life of its own, grinding forward regardless of truth or justice. The trial culminates in Miss Quested's stunning reversal. When finally asked if Aziz followed her into the cave, she hesitates before stating, "Dr. Aziz never followed me into the cave," and withdrawing all charges. The English contingent erupts in protest while Indians celebrate. The magistrate, Mr. Das, declares Aziz released without a stain on his character as the court dissolves into chaos. This moment of truth-telling represents both personal courage from Adela and a rare instance where colonial justice bends toward actual justice rather than reinforcing imperial power. The aftermath of the trial reveals the cost of truth in a colonial society. Adela, having withdrawn her accusation, finds herself completely abandoned by the English community. The shopkeepers carry her along as if she was invisible, while Ronnie postpones discussing their relationship until after Aziz's lawsuit for damages is settled, knowing he couldn't marry her without ending his career. Fielding arranges for Adela to stay at Government College, as no one at the civil station will receive her. He grows increasingly involved in her affairs, providing accommodation and helping her write an apology to Aziz. He observes that Indians know whether they are liked or not, and that justice never satisfies them, and that is why the British Empire rests on sand. Despite her genuine remorse, Adela's letter lacks true affection, revealing the limits of cross-cultural understanding even in moments of goodwill. Meanwhile, Aziz's victory transforms him. Initially jubilant, he soon grows harder and more cynical, telling Hamidullah that his great mistake has been taking our rulers as a joke. He expresses desire to leave British India for an Indian state where he might practice medicine and write poetry. When rumors circulate about Fielding visiting Misquested, Aziz immediately assumes betrayal, claiming, "No one is my friend, all are traitors." This suspicion poisons his friendship with Fielding. Though morally unconcerned about his friend's affairs, he resents the connection to his perceived enemy and the lack of confidence. When Fielding reacts with startled anger to Aziz's oblique accusation, calling him a little rotter, Aziz is deeply wounded, though outwardly dignified. The narrative observes that suspicion in the Oriental is a sort of malignant tumor that allows him to trust and mistrust at the same time. The trial's aftermath reveals how colonial structures damage not only political relationships, but personal ones. The possibility of true friendship across cultural divides, so promising in the novel's early scenes, seems increasingly remote as suspicion, resentment, and misunderstanding take hold. The machinery of empire grinds on, destroying human connections in its path. 2 years after the Marabar incident, the novel shifts to the Hindu state of Mau, where Professor Godbole serves as Minister of Education and Aziz has found refuge as court physician. The final section opens with the celebration of Krishna's birth at the palace temple, a scene of joyous religious ecstasy that contrasts sharply with the nihilistic emptiness of the Marabar caves. The temple ceremony represents a different approach to the universe's mysteries. While the caves offered only a meaningless echo, the temple celebrates divine incarnation. Infinite love took upon itself the form of Sri Krishna and saved the world. All sorrow vanishes in universal joy. After the birth, nobles play games to amuse the newborn god, including butter pranks and fondling children as Krishna's similitude. They break a jar of greasy rice and milk, sharing the divine mess without quarreling. Professor Godbole, covered in grease and dust, experiences spiritual visions of Mrs. Moore surrounded by faintly clinging forms of trouble. Though he's Brahmin and she Christian, he places himself in God's position to love her and in her position to call to God. Come, 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 come. This mystical connection across religious and cultural divides suggests a spiritual unity beneath apparent differences. Meanwhile, Aziz has found peace in Mau, though he remains bitter about Fielding's perceived betrayal. When Fielding arrives with his wife and her brother, Aziz initially refuses to help them, believing Fielding married Misquested. The crucial misunderstanding is revealed. Fielding actually married Stella Moore, Mrs. Moore's daughter. The brother-in-law is Ralph Moore, Mrs. Moore's son. This revelation creates the possibility of reconciliation. Though initially planning to treat Ralph roughly, Aziz is disarmed when Ralph observes that his hands are unkind. Despite his resistance, Aziz begins to feel drawn to this strange youth, who seems to sense his cruelty. Realizing Ralph is Mrs. Moore's son, Aziz experiences a change of heart, extending his hand in friendship. Learning that she loved you, Aziz is overcome with gratitude, calling Mrs. Moore my best friend in all the world. The Hindu celebration, with its emphasis on divine incarnation, love, and unity, provides a context for human reconciliation that was impossible in the stark emptiness of the caves or the rigid hierarchies of colonial Chandrapur. The benign confusion of the temple, where different forms blend and transform, allows for new possibilities of human connection. In the novel's final scene, Aziz and Fielding ride together for their last meeting, discussing their friendship and India's political future. Though reconciled, they acknowledge they must part ways. Fielding has married an Englishwoman and feels himself acquiring some of Anglo-India's limitations. The conversation shifts to politics, with both men having hardened their views. Aziz passionately declares that India will become independent. Free our women and India will be free. He grows increasingly excited, crying, "Clear out all you Turtons and Burtons," and predicting that India will seize its moment during the next European war. As they argue about who might replace the British, Aziz shouts, "India shall be a nation, no foreigners of any sort, Hindu and Muslim and Sikh and all shall be one." When Fielding asks why they can't be friends now, the landscape itself seems to answer. The horses swerve apart, the earth sends up dividing rocks, and all of Ma says in their hundred voices, "No, not yet." And the sky said, "No, not there." This ambiguous ending acknowledges both the yearning for connection and the historical forces that make such connection impossible in the colonial context. Written in 1924, the novel anticipates the independence and partition of India by more than two decades. The phrase "not yet" suggests both impossibility in the present moment and possibility in some undefined future. The friendship between Aziz and Fielding, like the relationship between Britain and India, cannot flourish under current conditions, but the door remains open to future reconciliation. The novel's final image, horses swerving apart, rocks rising between them, suggests that political realities will temporarily triumph over personal connections. Yet the phrase "not yet" holds out hope that someday, under different circumstances, genuine friendship might be possible. This tension between pessimism about the present and cautious hope for the future gives the novel its lasting power. Forster refuses both the comforting colonial myth of benevolent rule and the simplistic notion that the end of empire would immediately solve all problems. Instead, he offers a complex vision of human connection struggling against historical forces, a vision that remains relevant in our own divided world where we continue to seek passages between seemingly unbridgeable differences.